I had put out, I'm 415. And the only part that dispatch caught was teen. And actually one of my partners heard me and said, oh, that sounded like 415. Like, why else would she be saying teen? And then there was nothing else. And then we were in the middle of, like I said, fighting, and he has a hold in my left hand. So I'm basically trying to do everything with one hand. And then I try and put it out, I'm 415. And that's when dispatch, I think, started sending units my way. And then when it had gone for like a minute or two and I wasn't responding, she sent, you know, everybody, which without a doubt saved my life.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111, 110.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and today we have with us Megan McCarthy. Some of you may know her from some of the shit that's going on in her life. It's fucked up. And typical California. Typical fucking bullshit state, California, and being a police officer there and the county that you're in and what you went through and what the outcome was. It's ludicrous. And you've obviously been doing a little bit of a press tour, and we saw your story and we're like, well, obviously this would be an appropriate place for you to come and tell some of your story and give some context of what you've been through. So without further ado, thanks for being here today, and tell us who you are and where you work and where worked, and tell us about your fucking life.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity. My name's Megan. I'm 30 years old. I'm a mom of three. I'm married, and I am a medically retired police officer. I retired March of last year from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. I did about 3 years before my shooting, about 6 years total by the time it took me to retire. And I did some time in the jail, and I eventually went out to the city of Victorville, which is an awesome place in Southern California, and I did my patrol training there.
Obviously, you had time on the road. Tell us about the incident that took place and, you know, what ended up happening during your incident and some of the significant injuries that you sustained and all that shit.
Yeah. So it was my first call of the day. It was like 8:15 in the morning, just got out of briefing, and it came out as an unknown problem. We didn't have too much information over the air. All the mom was saying was, oh my God, get my son out of here. And at first it came out as like a priority two unknown problem. Well, while the mom's on the phone with 911, the line goes dead and you can still hear commotion in the background, but she's not responding to dispatch. So it gets bumped up to a priority one. I'm right in the area, so I decide to respond. The way the department works is we ride one-man units. You pretty much respond to most things by yourself. We don't have the manpower to respond to most situations with a partner, you know, if it's an active shooter or some domestics or, you know, a crime in progress, you try, but we're pretty short staffed. So I respond by myself. And as I'm walking up the driveway to make contact, the suspect comes walking out, beeline straight towards me. Mom's right behind him holding a knife, and she's still on the phone with 911. So we, you know, I try and do my encounter with him. I try and talk to him. I try and conduct a detention just to pat him down. You know, I definitely have enough to conduct that detention. I know that was a huge issue through trial, and you heard the defense attorney speak on, but crazy. And anyway, as I'm trying to conduct that pat down, he tells me, if we fight, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to headbutt the fuck out of you. And while he's telling me this, you know, my reactions kind of go, okay, this isn't going to be just a normal, like, hey, what's going on? Tell me how I can help. And so I start patting down his pockets, and he spins around, grabs my left hand, and won't let go. He's pulling it to the point where we're basically tug of warring on my wrist. He ends up breaking the base of my thumb. We fought for a good minute and a half before that video kicks on. I went through, you know, the rear wrist lock, the figure four. I tried all the defensive tactics I could. This guy was not having it. I tried my RCB. He grabs it from me. We fight over that. He throws it. And then the video kicks on when we're in the middle of the street. And he starts punching me in the face over and over. He broke this bone right underneath my eye socket. And I start feeling myself losing the fight. I can feel I'm starting to lose consciousness. Things are not feeling right. We end up going into the gravel. I had, you know, given him the warning, like, I'm going to shoot you. And he pins me on my back and I'm looking up and I fire around. I miss. And he traps my hand in the ground and his hand goes right into the trigger guard with mine. We discharge around into the ground and he overpowers me and takes my gun. So then I turn on to my hands and knees and I'm like, I got to get out of here. Like, I got to run. And I'm looking up and he's pointing the gun right at my forehead and I hear the trigger click. And I had so much pain to my face. The only thing logical in my brain was I had just been shot. So my legs were still working. My heart was still pumping. So we got to run. So as I'm running for cover, I hear another gunshot go off and I know he's shooting at me as I'm running away. Well, I didn't know this, but he had grabbed the back of my hair and had pulled me down trying to knee me during the fight and had disconnected my earpiece from my radio. And so I wasn't communicating to dispatch and she sent out basically a tone out for I need help. And my partners arrived just as he was basically hunting me down. So if the dispatcher wouldn't have done that, I no doubt would have been killed.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
We'll come back to some of my questions. So essentially this occurs, they get there. Do they fire at him?
Yeah, so there was rounds exchange. He fired a round at them. And then, you know, three of my partners tried to end the fight. And then he was taken by helicopter to the hospital.
So he was hit?
Yeah, he was shot quite a few times.
He lived, though?
Yeah, he lived.
So he's taken, he's airlifted to the hospital. Where are you taken with the injuries you sustained?
Well, it's not funny, but I guess you got to make lemonade out of lemons, right? So I'm actually put into the ambulance and they're taking off my vest and they're taking off my uniform shirt. And there's actually a segment on the news that you can see it. And he's on a gurney coming to the same ambulance that I'm in. So they kick me out of the ambulance and they put him in the ambulance to take him to the LZ to load onto the helicopter. So you see me coming out of the ambulance and I look down at him as he's on the gurney. And I end up going in the back of my lieutenant's car and then I'm taken to the station where an ambulance picked me up and we went to the hospital, but kind of odd.
Wow. What was your command saying on scene when this was going on? Were they just as appalled as you were?
I think everybody was really confused at what had happened, what took place. You know, you're obviously when my partners responded, I was hiding behind trash cans. I'm bloody and bruised and I'm obviously, you know, my adrenaline is running and there's a situation where a mom's holding a knife and everybody's like, what happened? So my sergeant comes up to me and he's like holding my shoulders and he's like, what happened? And you can actually hear it on my audio. And all I'm saying is he had me at gunpoint. And they're like, did he have a gun? I'm like, no, it's my gun. So I'm laying in the hospital bed and, you know, the sheriff and the undersheriff and CSI, everybody's responding. And the video had been posted to YouTube and I didn't know it. And everybody's kind of tiptoeing around, looking at me weird. And my sister was at the hospital with me and she's like, Megan, there's a video. I'm like, a video of what? And she's like, of your shooting. And my first instinct was, oh my God, people are going to see the worst minutes of my life. Like, how did somebody capture this and not come help me? And then I watched the video on YouTube and within hours it spread like wildfire.
So the video was being recorded by somebody else who was watching the event unfold. Who was that?
Yeah, he was a neighbor in an upstairs bedroom in another house. He testified during trial. I wasn't allowed to hear any other testimony for other witnesses, but what I gathered was he heard commotion and fighting. He was sleeping and he woke up and looked out the window and saw a cop and a person fighting. So his instinct was to record. And lo and behold, he recorded something pretty traumatic for me and decided to upload it to YouTube. And then it got captured on Twitter. And I'm like, I wish you would enough.
How did that make you feel?
Honestly, pretty shitty. I mean, this was back in 2019. So I feel like a lot of social media and the world has evolved since then. But even back, you know, next month will be 4 years since this happened. And my first instinct was, how crappy of you as a person to watch this happen. And your first thought is, I'm going to record, I'm going to try and get some views. You know, what happened to, oh my God, she looks like she needs help. Let me go help. Or let me call 911. I wonder maybe if her partners know that she's in a fight. But the fact that your instinct is, let me video this, that's, it just, it makes me kind of heartbroken at that. That's the community, you know?
Is the overall community where you work that sense of how they feel about the police?
Well, Victorville is rated number 9 in the top worst cities in all of California. So our major crimes are pretty bad. Our cop to people ratio is really low. You know, our gear and our training is pretty low. So I think people have a desire to go to neighboring agencies. So everything kind of works in tandem in negativity. And, you know, we have an area that is overrun by homeless. Like I said, we have a lot of, we have a 2 prisons up here. So that attracts, you know, a different population, and you have detention centers and stuff that release people to the street and they give them no other place to go. So the crime is just out of control.
How big is the agency you worked for?
Well, San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department is huge. I mean, we cover the most area in all of the United States as far as square miles go. We have a lot of different, you know, we have canine, we have aviation, we have SWAT, we have dive team, we have all of the things. We just can't keep the people. So, you know, California traps you with the good retirement and the benefits and pay. But when you can go through our academy and then you can jump over to, say, Ontario PD and make $15 more an hour, we just can't retain people. So we have the need for probably triple the cops, but we just can't get them.
Man. And then you got a story like this. It certainly isn't helping. So this guy spends time in the hospital, subsequently released. Is he jailed after that?
Yeah. So he was in custody the entire time up until, you know, the way the verdict was read. So he spent his time down at, it's called West Valley Detention Center. It's one of our jails in Rancho Cucamonga. So he was there in the, I can't remember the exact name it's called, but it's the severe mentally ill lockdown, I think is the classification. He spent his whole time in that unit.
So trial unfolds. He's charged, what I'm guessing, in an array of charges. He wants to go to trial. And what was their argument?
Yeah, he was originally charged with, I think, 12 different felonies, whole bunch of enhancements. He was looking at 60 to life. I mean, he was pretty stacked. He went through a couple of different attorneys during prelims, and then COVID hit, which caused everything to be delayed. And then somehow through the last, I don't know, year or so, he retained a private attorney, his name Raj Maleen, and he somehow got a hold of my guy's case. And their whole argument was, I didn't have a legal standard to conduct a detention or pat down. So basically, from the minute I put my hands on him, he was in self-defense and he was free to do whatever he wanted. And there's there's a few news articles where Raj speaks to the news outlet saying, you can punch a cop 100 times in the face and it wouldn't matter. If you believe that a cop isn't doing their job right, you can take their gun and shoot them. But I know he spoke to like Inside Edition and ABC and NBC, basically spewing this disgusting, illegal, incorrect rhetoric, telling people that you can murder a cop if you believe they're doing their job wrong. So that was somehow...
Was there any repercussions for him, like, with saying that? Did he get, like, the bar bring him up on any kind of charges?
Well, that's funny you ask. I have been asking every single person I can think of for nearly 3 months now since this happened. And I'm told There's different standards for prosecutors and defense attorneys. So he's not held to the same standard. And, you know, I have meetings with some people coming up this week to discuss some potential civil, you know, he violated my Sixth Amendment right. There's other things that happened in the courtroom that he said that were, you can't do, you know, he called me a racist. He told me that I wake up and I just want to kill people. And my attorney objected, and the judge overruled and let him just basically harass me for 3 days on the stand. So we're working towards it, but like everything, the justice system takes a while.
I'm assuming you have to follow counsel advice, but I know there's at least two or three ways you can file a formal complaint with the Bar Association against him, and they have to review it.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I'm exploring. I'm just trying to be very careful. We have some things that potentially we are hoping will unfold in the next couple months as far as those charges that the judge dismissed. So I'm just trying to be as politically correct and by the book as I can to make sure that at least something is done. We're trying to work with some people up in Sacramento to get that Assembly Bill 3070 reformed. And it's just, you know, the state of California does not like cops. They don't like anything that comes against supporting cops. So it's been a fight.
How has your prosecutor responded?
She's devastated, just like the rest of us. You know, I've been in contact with the district attorney, Jason Anderson, for San Bernardino County, and everybody is pretty baffled on how this happened. You know, we all recognize that there were some things that could have gone differently, but for the overall picture to be so heinous, we're all just trying to figure out how to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I think the major thing is getting rid of AB 3070. If we don't, then we can expect a lot more criminal and civil cases to end up like mine.
Jeez, what a disaster.
Yeah.
So is there any next process in the criminal justice system? An appeal on the, just a full jury not guilty on every count?
Yeah, they found him not guilty on the attempt murder, on the assault with a deadly weapon, and on the battery against a peace officer, I want to say. And they were hung on three other counts. One was resisting arrest, removal of a peace officer's firearm, and there was one other, I can't quite remember. But we actually went back on July 30th to have a motion heard about either dismissing the charges or setting trial dates. And because California decided to have such low sentencing guidelines that even if we went to trial and they found him guilty, he had already done the time, so there would be no sentencing benefit. So the judge just dismissed them, not even worried about it. So those were three major felonies that they basically said, no jail time anyway, just be free.
Where's this dude now?
It's terrifying to say, I don't know. You know, we live in the same geographical area, and he was told to stay down at a grandparent's house in Menifee, I want to say, but I have no idea. He got no probation, nobody to check in on him, nobody to respond to an office, nothing. He just is free, wandering among us.
Have you put thoughts into leaving the state of California?
Every single day. And I wish I was exaggerating when I say I do nothing but Google other departments and other places to live. And how do we get out of here? My husband still works for the sheriff's department. So he has about 11 years on. And, you know, unfortunately, the pay of California leaving would be about a 50% pay cut. And with the way the housing market is and cost of living, you wouldn't even be able to afford it. So we try extensively to look into other things, but I hate the fact that I live in this state, basically next door to him.
Yeah, I wonder if there really aren't any options. I mean, your husband would obviously have to maybe find a place where his 11 years could transfer over so he could have some credit towards his pension.
We've talked to a few departments federally, you know, neighboring Arizona, Texas, Utah, Idaho, and basically everybody says we could give you half credit would be the best. So instead of 11 years, it would be like 5.5, 6.5 maybe. And, you know, it's just kind of scary. We have young kids. So you try and weigh the pros and cons of what does California benefit us? And it's absolutely nothing except the fact that, you know, you have to have money and you have to have health insurance and you have to have benefits to survive. So we're just hoping that something will come up, or, you know, the housing market will get a little easier for people and we can get out of here.
Wild, man. Like, it's nuts. Have you had a lot of support coming to you after the verdict from outside sources?
Yeah. And that's been very comforting, is I am like blown away by the amount of people. I've had people write me letters and they're being sent to other stations and they're sending them to me. And just the outpour of love from people from all corners has been very comforting. You know, law enforcement is not like these days. It's, you know, you tell people you're a cop and you're immediately put in like this blacklist category. And so for me to come out so publicly of like, hey, I was a cop, now I'm a victim. Of course, you get the backlash. A lot of people did not care. A lot of people thought that I should have died that day and everything that happened was my fault. But the support of people by far outweighs all of that, which has been very comforting.
How did your agency respond to all of this? During it, after? Did they give you a hard time in the process of leaving on medical retirement?
No, they were actually really, really supportive. You know, there was a few people, a lot of my sergeants that were like, hey, if you want a different assignment, we can give it to you. At the time, it was Sheriff John McMahon. He would call me weekly and check in on me. He would, you know, offer to bring me dinner, or, hey, there's a spot open in downtown if you don't want to be on the street again. They were so accommodating, but it wasn't enough for the doctors to be convinced that I was able to return back to duty, because there's like 12 different requirements. And even if there's one that you can't fulfill, you're not allowed to be in the role of a deputy. And it was a hard pill to swallow. I wasn't up for the fact of going into like the civilian sector. It was either law enforcement or nothing. And the doctors said that that was up. So medically retired March of last year, and they were very supportive.
Well, that's good to hear. At least you had that part of it, because there are plenty of nightmares in this country of these administrations that almost after an incident unfolds, forgets about the significance of the trauma that somebody goes through. Man, it's just wild. So you guys run one-man units, like you said earlier, and you just don't have the manpower. So that's wild. When you were out there and you began to experience this gentleman starting to give you some indication that there's going to be some kind of conflict, were you able to actually send a distress call out on the radio?
Not really. I had put out, so our call for that is called 415. Basically means I need help, I'm in a fight. And the way that my lapel was like right here on my uniform, and then, like I said, it ran down my back. And I had put out, I'm 415. And the only part that dispatch caught was teen. And actually one of my partners heard me and said, oh, that sounded like 415. Like, why else would she be saying teen? And then there was nothing else. And then we were in the middle of, like I said, fighting, and he has a hold of my left hand. So I'm basically trying to do everything with one hand. And then I try and put it out, I'm 415. And that's when dispatch, I think, started sending units my way. And then when it had gone for like a minute or two and I wasn't responding, she sent, you know, everybody, which without a doubt saved my life. You know, if you watch the video, you see me run and he's walking right after me. The only thing that takes his attention is at the entrance of that cul-de-sac, my partners are lights and siren, and he's like turns and takes, you know, focuses on them, which isn't any better. You know, I don't want to say that my partners were sacrificial lambs for me to survive, but I had no other option. I knew I couldn't go bang on a front door and, you know, expose other people to an armed person. So it was basically fight or flight. That was all I had left.
You guys carry backup guns?
No. Well, you can. I did not. So, you know, I think in every instance, there's things to take away from it. And now that I've been sitting to dwell in my situation for almost 4 years, there are things I would have done differently. You know, I wish I would have done more ground combat. I wish I would have done more jujitsu. I wish I would have had a backup gun, you know, on my ankle, and I could have had that. You know, Monday morning quarterbacking isn't always great, but I think there are things to always take away.
Yeah. And, you know, I think earlier you said that you guys had shit training. You have no training and you're expected to do this job with like literally nothing almost.
Yeah. So, well, you know, they offer, it's called use of force training. So you go there every 3 months and you requal on your handgun and your off duty gun and your shotgun and your rifle. And then whether it's first aid, you know, active shooter, all these different things are quarterly trainings. But if you don't go to the range and if you don't go to the mat room and if you don't brush up on your skills, that's it. And that's definitely not enough. I mean, I know there's people out there that petition to go to other, you know, classes for whatever it may be in their specialty, and they're denied because we don't have enough manpower to cover their section on patrol. So it's like this revolving door of your people want to get better, but you have to let them get better.
You know, we talk about and constantly drill in our courses on this program about choose your hurt, you know, and I talk about the rehab that you're going to experience, the hours and hours and hours. So would you rather be rehabbing at a doctor's office or a surgeon's office or having surgeries or spending that time beforehand preventing this from happening? Like you said, hitting the mats, training jujitsu, putting thought into the what ifs. There's always got to be this time as a police officer in your life where you're going to have to take some responsibility to ensure that you get what you need to survive. And that's what I hear you saying today. You've given the advice that we constantly give, and you're living proof of what happens in a situation like that. You already said it. I'm not trying to make you as an example. I think it's a great message for everybody to remind them, and I'm begging them. I'm like, you guys are fucking insane to be in this job and at a very minimum, not taking protocols and putting them in place to ensure your safety, your own personal safety. And right alongside of that is the safety of others, because if you can't protect yourself, you can't protect anybody else. So, you know, the consequences are dire. And I think, who am I to judge? I'm not casting any judgment, but I'm thankful that you're alive. And so the consequences you paid were significant, but not the ultimate ones. Do you think about that a lot?
All the time, you know, and you hit the nail on the head. I hate that I'm this example, but I am willing to be this example, and I'm willing to be so raw and authentic about, you know, just thinking that a bulletproof vest and a handgun on your hip, people are going to care, or people are going to stop to think, you know what, maybe I should just comply. Those days are long gone. Like, you know, the days of just uniform presence, the people don't care anymore. I mean, I remember reading my suspect's statement when he spoke to homicide, and he said, yeah, I tried to kill her. She's a female. No female tells me what to do. So the logic of people is just backwards. So if you're not putting in the time to, you know, nobody wants to go to the range when it's 110 on their days off, but you have to do it anyway. You know, that's kind of my motto, is do it anyway. If you don't want to, you have to, because I don't want to say end up like me, because I have a beautiful family. I'm walking, I'm talking, I'm breathing, but I am so mentally fucked up from everything that has happened to me that I wouldn't want anybody to experience this. You know, mental health is a real thing. Those dark days are a real thing. We see the statistics, we see the numbers every single day. It seems like you're hearing it on FOP or whatever channel, and it's real. So I think about it all the time that the only reason why I'm alive is a malfunction, not because somebody stopped and spared me, not because I got shot and it bounced off and I'm okay. If there wouldn't have been a stovepipe in my gun, I would have been murdered that day. No doubt about it. So my mental health journey is far from over. This whole trial process has taken me years back, but you know, you got to put in the work. And I try and tell people, because I've had people message me, I was, you know, 2 months into the academy and I heard your story and I quit. I don't want to be a cop anymore. It's not worth it. I'll go back to Target. So I tell people, you know, like, the days of cops being something that people admired, long gone. If you don't do this for the right reasons, it's not going to end well.
So why did you become a cop?
I was definitely not that person that wanted to be a cop when I was, 5 years old. I didn't run around playing cops and robbers. I wanted to be a nurse, and I was actually in nursing school. And one of my friends said, "Hey, you should come for a ride along, like just, see what it's like." And I did. And that was it. That's when I realized that was the focus I wanted to help people in. I loved, this was back in 2015, and people still would wave at you when you're driving down the streets, and you would go to calls and people would be thankful that you were there to help, and you would respond to domestics and you would actually be able to make a difference. And a couple months later, I was in the academy and I loved it. I genuinely loved my job. Every single day I woke up excited to go to work. Obviously you have those long shifts, those long nights, but police work was what I thought my calling was, and it got taken from me.
Often we interview a lot of people who were significantly injured in the line of duty, and I'm certainly not discounting your experience. It's horrific. People don't see the mental scars that it takes, and I acknowledge that. We've heard from a lot of people what they were thinking of when the situation was happening, and the ones who survived are the only ones we get context from. So was there anything specific that day that you remembered thinking as you were almost murdered?
A lot of guilt. I have 3 kids now, but at the time it was just me and my daughter, and I was a single mom. And I was going to work every day for her and for me. And I dropped her off at kindergarten that morning, and we never say goodbye. I'll see you after school. And I went, put on my uniform, sat through briefing, went to that call. And I just remember, it's so weird when you go through something like that. It's like an out of body experience. Everything slows down. It gets really quiet. And I just remember when I'm looking up at him, I just felt so much guilt for her. How can you possibly go through life having your mom murdered? I'm so lucky that I still have my parents, but who was going to tell my daughter that I wasn't picking her up? Who was going to tuck her in at night? You just think of all of the things that you take for granted. And I just felt so bad. How did I end up in this position? Why did I ever go to this call? Why did I ever become a cop? I should have just stuck with a nurse. All these things. When people say it's like your life replays in slow motion, it definitely does. And, I still feel a lot of that guilt because I'm not the same mom that I was. I'm not the same person that I was. A lot of me changed that day. And I'm still trying to figure out how to be the new mom, the new Megan, the new sister, the new wife. And I still don't know really how to be, but it's a lot of feelings of guilt for sure.
Have you been seeking help?
Yeah, I've seen a therapist every single week since my incident. I've tried EMDR. I've been on 4 or 5 different prescription pills. I've done group therapy. I've done single therapy. I've done, different organizations where you connect with people, whether it's, through service animals, whether it's through different meditation type things. I've done everything because I know that if I don't, I will spiral. And I've definitely had those bad days. I would say it was probably August of the following year where I felt myself losing. My thoughts became very dark. And I remember looking at, the gun safe and looking at the prescription pills and thinking, nobody could stop me. I'm home alone, and everybody would be better off because I'm not who I was supposed to be. And I thank God that I didn't let those thoughts take over, but it's been a rough journey. And I have days where it's better, but it's not better. You just find better ways to cope with it.
What do you say to somebody who's having dark thoughts?
Have them, let yourself express them, however, will be productive for you. So that means if we shove our feelings down, that's when they compound and then something small triggers and it's an explosion. You have to let yourself have those dark days, those dark hours, but you have to be productive. So either go outside, go for a walk. I know it sounds very trivial, but these are things I do daily and I promise they help. Exercise, talk to somebody who gets it, whether it's reaching out through social media. I have people message me weekly. I have nobody else to talk to, but this is what I'm thinking. You know, what do I do? And I either put them in contact with different organizations or, hey, this is what I did when I felt like that. Or you're okay to feel that way. Don't feel like there's anything wrong with you, but we're going to work through it. And I've developed some amazing relationships through my DMs of people that have never dealt with PTSD or traumatic incidents, and they feel like they're not worthy of mental health. And that's when people shut down. So I think, you know, trying to normalize it and shatter those stigmas of mental health, I've been a huge advocate for it the last couple of years, but just let yourself be a human being.
This may sound a little crazy, but I feel like in life, every time that there is something very traumatic in our lives, in some way, shape, or form, some other blessing comes with it. Have you figured that out yet?
I think I'm getting there. I think that the last few months have been very wound opening for me. And I've found that before I would have just hermited myself. I would have just sat in bed in my PJs and been depressed and woe is me all day long. But instead, I go public on social media or I make little reels or, you know, I do stuff like this where I talk about it because it's healing for me. It gives me it must not be that weird if somebody wants to hear it. So the more I talk about it, the more, I don't want to say less personal it becomes, but the more like accepted. And I found that my new beginning may just be giving a voice to people that feel like they don't have one. And although that's kind of a scary journey to be on because it's very vulnerable, I feel like I owe it to the people that haven't been able to live through it to give a voice.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow. When I think about this situation, it's hard for a person to try to ever contemplate how there's some blessing in disguise here. But I go back to this saying that I didn't coin. It's been around forever. It's life happens for us, not to us. So you already said people were DMing you. They found comfort in you. Maybe God needed you to be this person for other people and put you through that. That was your boot camp. You had to have that happen because he knew that you would be strong enough to help others. And that's where the strength comes from, is knowing that you can impact other people's lives. And so we all go through a lot of stuff. And I think you're doing a really good job.
Thank you. Getting me all emotional here. I appreciate it because it's something that I feel so passionate about. One thing that I always get told from people, whether it's in the law enforcement community or just a mom who feels like she's drowning with her kids at home, is, well, I've never gone through what you went through, so why do I feel that way? And it's like we have this imagination of what mental health should look like or what PTSD should look like, that we don't allow ourselves to seek that help. And so I think by going to social media and showcasing that I have really bad days, you know, I post reels where I talk about suicide and I talk about my dark days, but then I also show like me and my kids at the beach because there is hope There is a place to go. There is a place to grow and evolve. Nobody is worthy of mental health. Nobody gets to fill out a questionnaire and say, oh yeah, you know, you qualify. I think that's the biggest load of BS, because everybody goes through things differently. There's people that maybe have gone through shootings and they feel emboldened by it. And then you have people that go through shootings and they can never return. And everybody is entitled to their own feelings. We don't have to pretend like they don't exist.
Do you feel like you're more compassionate now?
Yes and no. It's weird. I feel like my compassion for other people has really grown. I feel like a lot more empathy for people. I look through people in a different lens, but my compassion for myself is like dwindled to nothing. I don't really allow myself to like feel bad for myself, if that makes sense. I try and channel that through other means. And I think it's kind of like a coping mechanism, because you want to develop this like tough exterior, because I don't want to allow myself to feel a way. But then I go back and I'm like, if I don't feel my feelings, then I know where I'm going to end up. So I just try and channel all of my energy into other means. And that's super helpful for me.
You feel like you parent differently now? And if so, how?
1,000%. I mean, there is no doubt about it. My trigger is uncontrollableness. I don't think that's a word, but when I feel like I'm not in control of things, it's very hard for me to feel like safe. And I have an 8-month-old and a 2.5-year-old. And my daughter, she'll be 10 in October, so she's older. But my two littles, I mean, every day is different. Every day is the unknown. So I feel like my anxiety is a lot worse. But I try and, again, channel it into different means or different platforms instead of projecting it onto them. I mean, I'm definitely not here to sugarcoat and say like, oh, I'm the world's greatest parent. Far from it. I think I project a lot of my anxiety onto my kids. If there's, you know, a mess on the floor, I have to walk away because I get so worked up. Where in all reality, like, don't cry over spilled milk, right? Well, for me, it's like, that's the end of the world. Like, my day is ruined. I need to go take, you know, some time for myself. So it's just learning about how you react to things now, when, you know, the prior Megan would have been like, oh, no big deal. Now it's like, huge deal. Like, I don't go in grocery stores by myself. I don't pump gas by myself. I don't go to the park by myself. And so my kids miss out on that, but we got to survive.
You know, I hope that's something that you continue to address through your therapy sessions. And, you know, as a parent, I have 4 kids. I watch other people parent, and you know, sometimes we have to acknowledge what their perception is and how much damage we do. There's a book, I've said it so many times in this podcast. It's called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents. Now, I don't say that to you because I categorize you as somebody who's emotionally immature. What I'm saying to you is, it's a very good book to read as a caring parent, obviously, that helps you understand. You probably have to go through about 85% of the book, and then you'll be thankful that you read it or listened to it, whichever one you want to do. What that book for me did versus what I thought it was going to do was it taught me to understand how my kids perceive me. And so I try to really put thought into every action that I take and how, what their intent was, how they perceived their father responding to that situation. And again, I'm not claiming to be the best father in the world, but I do my very best to be the best father, conscious intention with morals and purpose of being the best dad I possibly can be. I guess the last thing before, you know, I let you respond to this is, I do watch parents who struggle with anxiety impose it upon their children. And I watch their kids be affected by it, where I think if you watch my kids, for the most part, they're pretty daring, pretty unafraid, pretty courageous. And I think emotionally very well balanced, where I see other kids who are very apprehensive because their parents have not let them be kids.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that you acknowledge some of this stuff. Clearly you understand what's happening and what you're doing, but that book is awesome. I don't own the book. I didn't write the book. I just think it's a good way to understand how your kids are perceiving you and then redirecting your behavior, even contrary to what your brain's telling you to do.
Yeah, I mean, you 100% right. I recognize that I'm sure I, whether it's subconsciously or unconsciously, project my fears onto them. You know, my little guys, I don't think that they're at that age where they really understand what that means. But I have had conversations with my daughter, you know, she just started fourth grade. And I think recognizing mental health is very important. You know, I tell her, she doesn't know what happened to me, but she obviously knows I don't go to work anymore and that something happened at work. But the ins and outs, I, you know, try and stay clear of that. But I think it's important to acknowledge that there are things that exist, because I would hate to have her potentially have anxiety or, you know, feelings and it's not talked about, because that's when things can turn ugly. But if you're free to express and talk about it, then we can find more productive ways to deal with it. You know, I just posted the other day, like when I'm feeling anxious or when I'm having a bad day, I put on music and we dance, because nobody can dance with a frown on your face. Nobody can dance like in a bad mood. You know, I hold my little guys and we just act silly and we play, you know, the freeze dance song. And within 5 minutes, our whole day is back on track. So I try and be very mindful, but, you know, I'm definitely not immune to the fact that as they get older, I'm sure I will have to dive deeper into my projections. Like you said, you know, reading about how they perceive us, I have to be accountable as a parent. You know, I can't just let them be little kids with all of these feelings and not address them. So, you know, like I said, I'm definitely not one that has ever shied away from holding myself accountable or being authentic and real. You know, I'm not the same wife that I was back then. I have my days where it seems like it's a me problem, and then I turn it into an us problem. And that's something that I work through therapy. I go, you know, like I said, I talk to therapists weekly, and, you know, everything is a work in progress, but it's just not giving up on that progress.
How do we go into fucking parenting from you getting the shit beat out of you?
You know, it's all related, right? Like, that's life, right? So, you know, we definitely went down the parenting rabbit hole, but at the end of the day, I think it's all related, right? Because you have to make decisions for your kids. You have to make decisions at work. What happens at home impacts work and vice versa. And it's just trying to find that balance and making everything cohesive.
Well, I think also making sure that we spare our children from some of our own anxieties was the overall theme of this. And really trying to understand the psychology, because the more you invest in your children and put that kind of effort forward and acknowledge our own behavior, the more you're going to see in a return of investment of that energy you put into folks, to your kids, essentially. I can't emphasize it enough, as I watch my children grow up and become with fault, but I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of the kids that they've become. And for some wild dudes, they're also some very compassionate, very thoughtful, very sharing. They're the dickhead moments, but I'm not trying to cast judgment. I know that people grow up in different socioeconomic environments. Believe me when I say this, like, I have complete compassion. I'm just saying, like, do I think it's a six-year-old's fault that they act that way? No.
Right.
Well, just imagine what's on the other side of it. You know, I always think about teachers and how many kids they have to deal with and how frustrated teachers get when kids misbehave. They have no idea what they're dealing with at home. Like, how many kids do you think go through the school system that were molested and raped? And these teachers have never come across it once. So they get frustrated with these kids who misbehave. When we go back to it, like, what if you found out that this kid was getting his ass beat every single day when he gets home, or getting raped every time he goes home? So he's coming to school, not functional. You're complaining to his parents. The parents are fucking beating this kid to death. Then he's getting beat more on your complaint. So it's just a world of complete stupidity. And when we're professionals in a sense of teachers, police officers, firemen, I'm not saying that some of this behavior that we see is acceptable, but at least we need to know as professionals where it comes from.
Absolutely. I mean, I was a school resource officer for 6 different elementary schools the year before my shooting, and you get a completely different grasp on how generationally, kids have become so just numb to criminalization. Like they don't even care about it. I mean, I still remember to this day, there was a, I think he must have been first or second grade, and he took a metal clipboard and he chucked it at his teacher, fractured his nose, split it open, had to have all these stitches. And I'm looking at this kid and I'm like, I can't take you to juvie. What can I even do? You need help. Like me, you know, being the policeman and, you know, spirit law, letter of the law isn't going to help you. You need actual help at home. And you go back to these houses and you're talking to the parents and they're just like, whatever, like, oh, Timmy just is aggressive or Johnny just is that way. And it like breaks your heart and it makes you realize that your job as a cop isn't just like clock in, clock out. You are imprinting on kids for generations. I mean, when they're growing up in these households that aren't taught right and wrong and good and bad, how can you expect them to not go to school and imprint on those kids? And then they're taking it to their house. And that was one thing that, not to get all like sensationalized, but that was one thing I loved about being a cop, because you don't even realize the lives you're touching that you may never even see. So, you know, like I said, do it anyway. If you don't want to take the time to sit and talk to a kid about real life feelings, do it anyway. If you don't want to go to that house and maybe try and offer some resources, do it anyway, because as you are seeing in California, when we're not holding people accountable, whether it's these kids doing these smash and grabs or popping open trunks at gas stations and stealing stuff, how do we expect them not to create this firestorm of just crime? And that's exactly what's happening. I saw some crazy things in elementary schools that I think people don't even know exist. And I think we owe it not just as parents, but as human beings to do it anyway.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking about like David Goggins' story. Have you ever read his book?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it was just a severe, severely abusive childhood. His father was horrific. And what it caused for him psychologically clearly is what you see today. And it's a man who has taken that, and you know, people want to hate on David Goggins. You still can't take away from the guy what he's accomplished. I hate when people, I fucking can't stand when people want to cast judgment on others or project their opinion on a guy who runs ultra marathons. And it makes me nuts. Like, you're just, people should really check themselves before they start projecting their thoughts. You have nothing nice to say, don't say it at all.
Yeah. I think social media has been a huge demise on that, because you don't have to worry about the backlash of a real human being. You can just say whatever you want through a keyboard, you know, not to talk about myself, but man, some of the comments that people have said since I went public with this, and obviously on different, you know, national platforms, you have to welcome the good, bad, and ugly, but you see a different side to human beings that almost makes you like sad for them, because how people have so much hate and discontent for somebody that they don't even know, or that they're just seeing talk about something. I would receive dozens of messages of people like, this world would have been better off if you died, like your poor daughter has to have you as a mom, and you know, fuck the cops, and you would have been better off buried. And it's like, where have we become where that's just like okay? You know, even if I hate someone or I don't agree with what they're doing, if it's not constructive, then what's the point? And it's just, you know, again, that mental health, it plays such a detrimental role in people that I think, you know, unless we start getting that pendulum swinging back, it's going to be a scary world for our kids.
I have learned that people are just in a bad place. I think they're very undereducated, and not in the sense of the formal education of they have more skills. I'm talking about an emotional intelligence. And if you weren't raised that way, to try to learn that, it must be with intention, because I'm going to be 42 this year. And I still every day try to practice being a better human being and trying to approach everything with more emotional intelligence. And I do it with intent. I mean, I really made a decision maybe 10 years ago, and I'm still working on it. I still have moments. And I got to be honest with you, typically it's the crowds that you surround yourself with is how you're going to behave. Mm-hmm. So I'll hang out with some people who are like shit talking. You just go along for the ride. And so that's why I don't have a lot of friends, to be honest with you. And the ones that I do, I'm elated to be around, because they see things the way that I see things. And I'm happy with the way I see things. I'm not always right, but I really try to approach things with a non-biased mind. And that's not some hippy dippy shit that I'm talking about, that I like, I'm on the coastline of California. Like, yeah, man, I'm like, nah, like I'm mature enough to understand some shit. And right. I say these things publicly because I want people to maybe hear it as well. Maybe because a lot of feedback I get in this podcast is, you didn't only just change the way I do police work, but you changed the way I think. And if it speaks to you, listen, follow it, man. I'm not the one who invented this. I just learned these things from other people. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't able to lean on those in my life to learn how to actually behave. I had to employ outside resources, namely in books, videos, podcasts. I got to tell you, there's a, while we might criticize social media quite a bit for all the downfalls of it, I believe there's a lot of benefit. I mean, I still, in my algorithm, there's a lot of like motivational stuff and like, and that stuff's really important and like reminds me of really good shit. So there's great stuff on social media as well as bad stuff on social media.
Definitely. I think, you know, you're a product of your environment at the end of the day. Birds of a feather flock together. If you don't want to be associated with a certain type of way or thinking, then don't associate with it. And, you know, like you said, social media traditionally has had a bad rap. But I think social media is what you make it. We can't avoid it. Everybody has it. So you get to pick what you use it for. And if you want to go to connect with people to see, you know, like you're talking motivation and training and things that are beneficial, then that just speaks towards your character and type of person you are. If you want to go on social media to be a troll, then that's just the way you are as a person. And nothing we do or say is ever going to change that. But I think if we have the opportunity, you know, like you do with your company and with the trainings you host and the conferences and podcasts, if you have the opportunity to potentially reach one person, then that's enough. And that is one thing that I remind myself all the time is, sometimes I hate being so public and vulnerable, but if I can help one person not to feel like they want to go shoot themselves, then that's all I can do. And without social media, who would you connect with? So I think that we just have to be so grateful that we have the ability to touch people and reach people, because people need that. I mean, speaking for myself, I need people like you to be real and authentic and no bullshit. And this is what it is. And that's how you get better. Because when you start to, you know, try and wrap it pretty with a bow and put some sprinkles on top, that doesn't help people. I can say for myself, that just makes me feel worse, because then I'm like, why am I so jacked up? But when it's like, hey, yeah, I am messed up. Hey, I need to be more accountable. Hey, I need to not project onto my kids. It's helpful. So it's, we owe it to people to be the best versions of ourselves that we possibly can be.
What's the detriment of not saying it, right? Like, what's the consequence? You know, people have written to me and said, I'm a better parent because of this podcast. Like, I've had some real heartfelt shit come over that people were like, yo, I didn't know I was this fucked up. And you like helped me realize that. And I'm good with the vulnerability on the consequences that I have to face with some of the things that I have going on in my life. It's like the videos when we have to critique police videos. People are like, you know, I get the criticisms. Like, did you really have to fucking put that video up and say those things? That guy's still in the hospital. And I'm like, I understand. But what happens when I don't? Right. What happens when I don't remind the 15, 20, 40, 600, 12, 11, 3 police officers of the seriousness of this job and those mistakes that person made? Like, what happens then? So while I know it's frustrating for you, there are consequences to not saying something. And I don't know if I could live with that, because I don't want to blink and miss it and cost somebody their life, because the work we've done has saved so many lives. And it sounds so cliche, but I have the proof.
Yeah.
I know for a fact the efforts of everybody, including our community, our instructors, and our staff here, have kept several names off that wall in Washington, D.C. I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
So I'm getting put through the fucking grinder emotionally, which I'm in it quite a bit. I am reminded of why. And I think that's an important reason to show up and continue and to ignore the naysayers. And a lot of the naysayers, they're either very unintelligent or in a really bad place in their life. And I know some of the people. I've had people I thought were my friends talking tons of shit about me on social media. Other police officers who I thought were my friends. And I'm like, yo, I know that's you. And they're like, well, you know, I was just kidding around. And I'm like, yeah, I understand you were just kidding around. But like, there's a human being on the other end of this, you know, just so you know. For me, it kind of rolls off my back like water on duck's feathers. But I have family and friends. You think these things don't impact them? You think they don't see this stuff? You think people here that work for this company and it's their life and their career, it means nothing to them? You think my kids won't see these things eventually one day? And that's how you're going to get back at me through right. the eyes of my children when they ask me questions about stuff like that? Because I'm trying to help because you don't like the bravado-ness of New Jersey and cursing? Like, fuck, you want me to tell you, dude? Like, this is how I communicate. But behind it's a good purpose. And people have just lost their way.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. But I'm willing to deal with that for the result.
Well, I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. Like, I remember talking to my attorney after the verdict was read, and she pulled some jurors and, you know, what happened. And a lot of them told her that they couldn't get over my fake eyelashes. I was not credible. I seemed like I cried too much, so I wasn't believable. And you look at me and sure, I have makeup on and I have fake eyelashes because that's a guard for me. It's a protection. But does that minimize what happened to me at all? Does that take away the fact that I'm a human being that has the same color blood that you do? You know, just because I may take the disgusting comments on social media and I read them and block and delete, that doesn't mean if you go do it to the next person that they're not going to commit suicide. And it's like you said, what is the consequence of not saying something? And I told myself from the get-go that if I sit idly by, I am just allowing this to happen to more people. I heard from sheriffs and chiefs and people all up and down California, like, what's Assembly Bill 3070? I've never heard of this. And I'm like, what the hell? You need to go Google it because this is not going to just impact you, but all of law enforcement and all of the community. Like, it literally impacts every single person that lives in California. So if we don't say something, it's worse than
inaction.
Exactly. I'm like, I can take it, you know, although some of the comments kind of strike a nerve and it makes me feel a little, you know, weird about myself, like whatever, because the people that I've talked to that I've said like, hey, thank you for being so real, or thank you for talking about this because I went through an incident and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I will take that one person and put them up against the 1,000 negative comments and I will sleep happy at night. It's a game of Russian roulette that I'm willing to play.
One last message for fellow law enforcement in the field that you can give them. Let me just preface with this. Like, they're not leaving, right? So I always tell people that.
Yeah.
So the solution is nobody's leaving. Very, very few are electively leaving on their own accord, not being forced to leave, just deciding this is not for them anymore. Very, very, very few. So the solution isn't run, fuck the world. They still have to show up. People have asked me in the past, like, will you go to like Seattle, Washington and teach those cops? Of course, like more than anybody. Those men and women still show up. You think they deserve us turning our back on them because their city council's a piece of shit? They're still showing up. They need it more than anybody. So we will never do that. With the preface of people aren't leaving, what advice through your experiences can you give fellow men and women in law enforcement?
Do it anyway. And I know I keep saying that, and that's something that I've had to drill into my own brain for the last, I don't know, 1400 days, is do it anyway. If you don't want to go to the mat room, do it anyway. If you don't want to sit and brush up on case law, do it anyway. If you feel like you need to use some of your paid time off that you have banked for a mental health day, do it anyway. And that is one thing that I feel like has become almost normal, is we are so overworked. We are so underpaid. We are so overstimulated in the fact that, you know, our numbers are low. I have to be there. I have to show up, but who's going to show up for you? So if you feel like you need something, whether it's extra training, extra days off, extra X, Y, and Z, do it. Because I am living proof that I wish I would have. And of course, hindsight's 2020, right? But I don't know if my situation would have ended up differently if I would have been more familiar with jujitsu or retention shooting. I never once got taught how to shoot on my back and aim at somebody as they're fighting you. Put yourself in uncomfortable situations and become better and evolve, because if you stay stagnant, that's when things get a little, you know, hazy. So I know that's very long-winded and I apologize, but I think it's very important to try and stay motivated for yourself, however that looks like.
That was a perfect answer.
Oh, good.
Is there anything else you want people to know about you or where they can find you or supporting a cause or anything like that?
I mean, just support your people, your partners. If you look around the briefing room and somebody looks like they're having a hard time, go be that uncomfortable person to have a conversation, because I am so impassioned about mental health and being there for each other. Whether you need to reach out to organizations like your podcast and you need training on, you know, vehicle interdiction or case law study, or you need to go to the Wounded Blue and get some mental health help. There are so many different places out there to reach out to, but look out for your partners and look out for yourself, because this world does not need somebody to show up for work that's just going to sit in their police car and kill themselves or go home and kill themselves. Look out for yourself and do what you need to.
This has been really good. What a great podcast. Phenomenal episode.
Thank you.
I appreciate you carving some time out of your day to do this with me.
Thanks for having me. It means a lot.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at StreetCop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at StreetCop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.